Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of One Song, this time with the brilliant Adrian Crowley, who was kind enough to indulge me in a conversation about his Crow song, which I requested that we talk about after hearing him perform it last year. It's a beautiful piece centered around his experience of having a crow come into his life as a child, and that crow left a mark, as you'll hear. I've always loved Adrian's deep, booming voice. He's a masterful storyteller and a sweetheart of a man. So I hope you like this one.
What is a song?
Where do songs come from? What is the life of a song?
How much can a song morph and change before it becomes something else entirely?
Adrian Crowley.
Wow. I can hear echoes.
Yes.
Nice.
Those are intentional. Those are
so
intentional.
You can see me. You can see me and hear me.
You look beautiful, Adrian.
Oh, thanks.
I can see your guitars in the background. Oh,
yeah. And you can see the pink walls.
Yeah. Is that your studio?
Very pink, isn't it? This is my all-purpose room.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be my daughter's room when she was away on holidays. I painted it pink. And then she came home and she said, "What have you done?" And I said, "I've painted your room your favorite color." She said, my favorite color is yellow. Well, it used to be pink.
Well,
but I find it soothing.
It is. It's soothing
sort
to my eyes right now.
Flavored. Good.
Yeah. Well, Adrian, I have three introductory questions I've been asking everyone. Do you mind if I just go ahead and hit you with those?
Go ahead.
Number one, how many years have you been on this earth? Number two, where in the world are you right now? And number three, can you please tell me about the last meal that you ate?
Yes. I've been on this earth for 52 years. And right now, I'm in North Strand in Dublin. And I'm looking out the window and I see rain and more rain bouncing off the rooftops and against the window pane. And my last meal, it was breakfast. And I had a bagel.
Ooh.
Scrambled eggs and salmon. And salmon chopped up and put inside.
I'm a big bagel man myself. Yeah. I grew up eating bagels. And every time I go to New York, I make sure to go and get a good bagel. I mean, the best bagels. Have you had a real New York bagel?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Many times.
You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's incredible. And, you know, starting the day with a bagel in New York and walking to where you're going with a coffee. Well, I like to drink coffee, too. Everything bagel. You know, the different kinds.
Are you asking me what's my favorite type of bagel?
I suppose.
Or are you saying that your favorite type isn't? It sounded like a question. Everything bagel?
Yeah. It's sort of like what the person says to me when they see me after going there every morning for A few weeks, they see me and they say, "Everything bagel?" And I say, "Yes, that's usually what I ask for." But yes, I suppose I was asking you what you thought of an everything bagel.
Or do I just think that everything should be about bagels? Everything bagel? It's a great question out of context. But no, I do enjoy the everything bagel, and but I like to change it up. I like to try them all. I've got a soft spot for pumpernickel as well.
Oh,
Those really dark ones.
I was just thinking of that.
Yeah. And
I
then
was
they've
trying
got
to
all the
remember what the dark
schmears,
ones.
the schmear, the different cheesy, creamy spreads with all the different flavors. And you see them all piled on those plates. For anyone who's not been to New York and seen like a classic New York bagel shop, it really is quite a spectacle. There's a whole style of it. All these different plates with all these different spreads and, all these different baskets with bagels in it. And most people probably know what we're talking about, but for those who don't, it's real and it's awesome.
I concur. Yes. There's this place near Columbus Circle, across from where my cousin used to live. It's like a deli, with loads of signs outside, and it's sort of like a mini supermarket as well. And the bagel counter is just incredible, you know. I want to go back.
Have you ever tried to make bagels yourself?
Never.
It's not.
I think you'd be good at making them.
Well, I've only tried once with my mother because I was such a bagel fanatic. You really struck a chord in me with this bagel thing, Adrian. So pardon me if I'm ranting here.
Glad I did.
But because I loved bagels so much, my mother said to me one day, "Hey, Peter, we should make bagels," when I was a kid. And I said, "Okay, yeah, bagels, And we spent like what felt like all day to me. When I think back of it now, it felt like it took us ages to get these bagels because you make the dough, and then at some point you make all the shapes of the bagels. And I might be wrong about this, but I think the process is you drop them in boiling water first and then you bake them. I think so you make the shape of the bagels, right? And then you drop them in boiling water, and then I think that's how you do it. I mean, maybe this is why we failed so miserably. But what happened was we had, 40, 50 little bagels all made up, and we got the water boiling. We were so excited to see what happens when, like, how does this work when you drop the bagel in the water? And we dropped the first one in, and it just disintegrated into the water.
Oh no.
Was horrible. And we tried another, and it did the same thing, and it was a massive failure that I'll never forget.
Bagel sludge. You made
Bagel
bagel
sludge.
sludge instead.
Yeah, gross.
Oh no. It's a bit
Well,
like when you make it's a bit like when you make poached eggs, and you get
right.
it
They say the
wrong.
trick
Anyway.
is to put a bit of vinegar in the
Yeah.
water.
I do that now.
Yeah, well, we can move on from edibles for a moment. And
Okay.
so thanks so much for doing this. I want to talk about your song Crow Song, from your new album, The Watchful Eye of the Stars. And I have a general sort of way we could structure this that I'll run past you and see if you think that's a good way to do it. But actually, maybe first we could give a little bit of introduction as to how and you and I know each other. Do you remember the day we met,
Yeah.
actually? The first time.
Yeah. I was thinking about that and I wasn't sure if you remembered.
I think we've talked about it.
We have. So we first met on tour. You were touring with Efterklang. I was touring around Europe. Mm-hmm. And I had my own shows interspersed with shows with others where I was opening for. There were two other groups on that tour that I was opening up for. Efterklang was one, and you were in the band at the time. So as far as I remember, we did two concerts, one in Germany. I think it was Leipzig or okay. Bochum, one of the
two. I couldn't
two.
Remember where it was, but yeah, I remember yeah. the meeting you, yeah, with Efterklang.
Yes, and the other one was in Amsterdam, and we played in Melkweg.
Right.
And you were very friendly, actually. You recognized me from the previous gig or something. Uh-huh. And before the concert in Amsterdam, there's like a cafeteria in Melkweg, or a cafe.
Yeah.
And I was at a table by myself having a meal. And you were with the band on your over on the other side, and you saw me and you went, come on over. Oh. Yeah. So I kind of think of that as the first time we met.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't remember that moment, but what I remember is kind of being with you just off the stage at one of the gigs and kind of watching you from the side of the stage. Mm. And I remember you singing a song about bees.
Okay.
The honeybee or buzzing bee. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, yeah. I have a song called The Beekeeper's Wife. And I also covered an Ivor Cutler song, which was about bees and was called Squeeze Bees.
Oh, right. Okay.
So there were two bee songs in my set.
All right. Well, maybe that's why the bees are so prominently in my memory. I just associate you with singing about bees.
That's nice.
But now you're singing about... Actually, when I was going and looking through, you know, your list of songs and the titles in the last few days. And I realized that animals kind of come up. Animals and wildlife and the natural world are somewhat of a reoccurring theme. Like, you've got the magpie song and crow song. There's a song, the wild boar. There's the silver birch tree. And these are all, yeah. you know... characters in our wild landscape.
Yes. I think in all of those that you mentioned, there's this dimension also within the story and within the characters so it's not just a walk in the countryside, for instance. Well, it's hard to explain what I mean by that. I'm sort of fascinated by how some things feel like archetypes to me, and also a simple nothing is simple for a start. There's in all those story songs you mentioned, there's another element underlying everything, and it's sort of like almost like the there's a crossover psychic energy embodying each one of these things that reaches out and affects the other in the story.
I like it.
And it, like in the wild boar, it's like it's not just a creature. I mean there's a supernatural element to all of them. That's the first thing I should say.
And a actually. Symbolic sort of, you know, whole sort of body of content or something. I'm not putting that right, but I know what you mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, I was going to, I decided not to say something because it sounded misleading. I was going to say it's not just a simple walk in the countryside, but that's a purely subjective thing.
Yeah.
Nothing is a simple walk in the countryside. So, you know.
Oh, I hear seagulls there.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I'll open the window.
Yeah.
You can hear them more than my next door neighbor likes to feed the seagulls. And something has started happening recently. They've just decided to wait on my house, on the roof of my house, and on the roof of the opposite house. And they just congregate. And I sleep next to, quite close to a fireplace. And it's like an echo chamber. The chimney is like an echo chamber to the voices of the seagulls. So I wake up to this sort of tubular bird song coming down into my room. Tubular, you know, because it's coming down the chimney, you know, so it's it's amazing.
Well, maybe the seagull, if it keeps messing with you enough and showing up in your life, maybe it'll maybe the seagull wants to make itself into a song.
Ah, that could be it.
Okay, back to how we met. So that's the first time we met, but we met again years later through my wife partner, Bridget May Power, because you are from Ireland. You grew up actually right by where we live now. Although you're in Dublin now and we're in the west of Ireland, but this is the area where you grew up. But yeah, when I met Bridget in 2014, 2015, I think you guys met somewhere around that time as well, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And you guys, I remember you guys collaborated on a song of yours. And I remember seeing, like, just as I was getting to know her, like finding out that she was working with you and thinking, oh, what a small world. You know, I met that guy. And but now I live over here and, you know, we've done multiple things together over the years, been on the same bill for different shows. And I think the last time I saw you, actually, we went fishing together. We had been talking about trying to go fishing for ages. And we finally made it happen.
Yes, that was amazing. Also, this summer, maybe late summer, we can go out again and hopefully catch mackerel.
Yeah.
And I was walking on a strand last week on Bull Island, and I found this stretch of sand covered in big, fat lugworm casts, the ones we were looking for.
The ones we were looking for.
Yeah.
Yes, we must fishing. Try again because, ladies and gentlemen and folks, everyone, it was a bit of a failure, our fishing endeavor. We came back empty-handed, but we had a good time nonetheless.
We did. And I should specify, in case anyone notices, we started talking about fishing for mackerel. Then I mentioned bait, because obviously you don't catch mackerel with lugworms. We were looking for lugworms because we wanted to go fishing for rockfish, also known as wrasse.
Which
I have yet to show you, yes.
But which you also told me you were writing a song about, weren't you?
That's right, yeah.
The Ballin Wrasse.
Yeah. Yes.
So there's another character from the landscape.
Yes, I haven't recorded it yet, but yes, it's still bouncing around in my head.
Yeah. Sorry if I'm giving anything away here.
No, that's okay.
Secrets from your future. You heard it here first, folks. Yeah. Well, okay, so that's how we met. Actually, I think maybe the last time I saw you was in December when we did this little filmed concert together. That was after the fishing trip, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was.
And that was when I first heard Crow Song.
Ah.
Because you played it there. So Adrian and I did this concert together, which is what you can see on YouTube. It was just a filmed thing in December 2020 when things, after a year of sort of lockdown, things in Ireland kind of opened up a little bit in these few weeks leading up to Christmas. And there was a lot of venues at that time wanting to do like gigs with no audience, but with a camera crew where the gig would get streamed out. So Adrian and I ended up doing a little gig together, and there was no one else there, us and the camera crew, but you know, we got to sit and watch each other. And I think it was kind of an odd feeling to be just in the same room with someone making music. And I sat there and watched you perform. And I was very impacted by the Crow song. And I remember watching and listening to the story, wondering if it was a true story or if it was something that you know, a fiction that you had made up. And towards the end of the song, you delivered one of the lines, and it sounded to me like you were getting choked up a little bit. And I thought, oh, this must be a real story. And I thought, but even if not, like, you know, he's embodying the emotion of this story. But I thought at that moment, I thought, oh, this must be real, you know, cause it's coming out as if it's a real memory of your own. So I was thinking maybe what we could do is we could come back at the very end of the show and actually play the clip from that show. And in the meantime, we could talk more about the album version and play that at some point.
Right. Yes.
But because the song itself is a story, you know, and I don't want to do is ask you a question that makes you tell a detail that's already in the lyrics, you know?
Yes. I understand.
So I thought
that.
What we could do is maybe we could first talk about, cause I'm interested not only in the song and the content of the song, but the actual recording of the song and the more technical things around the song, if you will.
Great.
So I thought maybe we could talk a bit about that song and you know, also its context in your new album, kind of how it was recorded and instrumentation, any technical details. We could maybe then listen to it and then come back and fill in the story itself with any extra details.
Great. Absolutely.
Okay. Sounds well, you take it away then.
Okay, well, so indeed, I had thought about capturing this idea for song into music because it had existed in a different form before. I had written a short story called Dark Visitor, and it's basically an extended version of the song as you know it. And I thought, you know, the fact that it was on paper, on the page, was great, and it was published in a book.
Oh, was it?
But it was. I've got it here because I thought it would be interesting for you to see.
Yeah, please.
So you might be able to see the title there, Dark Visitor. It was in this book called Sunday Miscellany.
Fantastic.
So I can't remember how many years. I think about 6 years ago it was published. So it kept coming back to me. The story kept returning to me when I was making music. And initially I thought I'd just read the story as it appears in that book there. But I had a sort of different flow in mind. I don't know. It re-insisted itself on me, and I rewrote the story in a simpler form, you know. I sort of distilled it down into a few pages, and I wrote it. I wrote it in a book like this, and in the recording, you can hear me turn the pages.
Yes, yes, I love that moment. Yeah.
So that is from this very book. Now, earlier on this morning, I thought I'd go and look for this book, so I could show you the words that I'd written down for that recording. But I think I tore them out. So they're somewhere else in this room. But, because, you know, it's a spiral-bound notebook. But it was definitely this book. And you might recognize the sound.
And it's huge for people who might be just listening this. I mean, when I was listening to the song again this morning, I was struck by, because, you know, you hear the music and the voice, and it all puts you in this certain, this quite mystical, mysterious kind of space. And then all of a sudden in the middle, you hear this like big fat page turn, and it kind of like jolts you into suddenly realizing like, wait, this is a person reading something.
Exactly.
And I love that. And seeing that book now, I realize why that page turn is so loud.
Yeah, it's kind of art paper, you know. It's so heavy. It's not just your regular notebook page. So yes, and then I was recording the bones of my album at home in this room. With just a few instruments and this pedal here, which it's an Electro Harmonix 45,000.
Can you hold that up again? What is that? It's got lots of little knobs.
So cool. It's so cool. Right. It's a bit like, it's designed like an old four-track. I don't know if you ever used 4-track.
I did, yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, so it's got these 4-tracks where you can record loops into.
Mm-hmm.
And then, actually, you can record quite long loops, maybe like 20 seconds or more. I can't remember exactly how long. And you can adjust the pitch then, you know, with this. It goes up and up. It goes all up and down, and you can adjust. There's a button where you can switch it into a lower octave, right, and also adjust the pitch, and there's a reverse. So I was creating these kind of soundscapes. I wasn't really sure where I was going with them, because I was interested in creating an aural mood board where I could just like jump in, mm-hmm, and see what comes back out again, sort of like diving into this pool of organic sound.
Yeah.
Cause I was looking for a kind of atmosphere that would suit the kind of story I wanted to tell in the song without thinking too much of chords or, you know,
technical
structures
musical
or anything.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted, it's almost like in this other discipline of filmmaking where someone has an idea to make something, but first they want to show someone the kind of style or what it evokes rather than a mood. Use any words. Yeah. So the mood, exactly. So they make a mood board. So that's kind of what I was doing. Mm-hmm. So then I created with my Mellotron.
Yes.
Purely.
Adrian.
Yes.
I would, the Mellotron has been a strong character in your recent work. And it's the sound of Crow Song. So I thought, you know, there's going to be people listening to this as well who don't know what a Mellotron is. And I thought it'd be cool to even just talk about that for a moment as well, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. Okay. I am absolutely bowled over by the Mellotron. totally fascinated. Now, the first time I ever read the word Mellotron was when I was looking at the back of a record by David Bowie. It was Diamond Dogs. And this album, I was totally enchanted by this album when I was a teenager, 14 years old or so, when I was in school. And you know when you're listening to a record and you don't really think of it as a collection of instruments and notes. You just think of it as this strange creature, this amorphous, organic thing that is singing to you, you know?
Yeah, you just and get the feeling from it, the vibe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that album really had that quality for me. The music behind his voice, even the way he was performing, of course, the sound of his voice and his delivery, it all had this mood. But then I thought, oh, of course, wait a minute. People played that.
Yeah.
You know? I kind of forgot.
Yeah.
Oh, because it sounds like a dream. It sounds like somehow this magician had managed to get some kind of magnetic tape and record someone's dreams and sound and play it back. That's what it sounded like to me. And it was warbly and it sort of blended and bled together and all these strange sounds. I didn't know what the heck they were, you know?
Mm.
So one day at home, I thought, I'm going to just read the liner notes, you know? So I read the liner notes and I read all the credits that all the instruments that David Bowie played. And one of them was Mellotron. So that was my first time ever hearing or seeing the word. And so for anyone that doesn't know, well, the original Mellotron, because now present day, there's a digital version.
Right.
Which is beautifully done. And mm-hmm. it's basically one dude called Marcus in Scandinavia who acquired all the original tapes that were part of the original Mellotron, because the original Mellotron is this amazing analog type of organ, big white thing mm-hmm. with a big lid. And you open up the lid and it's basically like a stubby piano, you know. It's got like around 58 keys or something like that. Yeah. I'm not sure exactly how many, but each in the original analog Mellotron, each key was connected to a tape. Yeah. A lot of people say they were early samplers, but that isn't actually true. It's not exactly that, because when you think about the mechanics of a Mellotron, it was painstakingly put together. Apparently, you could change the sound. Oh, I'm not sure if I'm explaining it right. Okay, say the most famous Mellotron sound would probably be on Strawberry Fields by the Beatles, the mm-hmm. intro, that fluty, warbly sound.
Yeah.
So every single key triggers a tape with a long note. It plays a long note of, say, a blend of flutes. It could be a quartet of strings. It could be choirs. It could be cello. But each note is recorded separately, you see, and put onto this tape. It's not like there is one sound and then you play a different note.
I actually thought it was one sound that got speeded up or slowed down.
But they're all done separately.
So if you imagine, you know, you hit a piano, you hit the note A on a piano, but in a Mellotron, when you hit that A, it's playing a recording of someone playing that A on a flute or a cello or whatever the different sound is.
Exactly. And I think it's 9 seconds. I think that was the length of it. of the tape.
Right.
Where you hit the note and it would play it out for 9 seconds, and this is the weird, this is the cool thing, I think. You kept your note, your finger on the key, and when it came to the end, the tape would go back to the beginning.
Uh-huh.
Would flip back to the beginning, and over time, the ribbons and all these, the tape ribbons would become distressed, and they deteriorate over time, and they'd stretch, and they would start getting all warbly, and they were notoriously difficult instruments to bring on the road because they were so fragile,
right?
And they'd break easily. And as far as I know, if you wanted to change the sound, you had to lift out this massive tray of loops of tape and insert a new one like this crazy cartridge and put it all in again and close the lid and then play. So they were not the most practical for bringing on tour. Anyway, I was totally fascinated by this instrument. And I, what I really love is how, you know, like, you have an old cassette where you listen to an album. I know it's a thing of the distant past, but cassettes would get distressed over time, and they would warble and speed up and slow down, which is a great sound in music.
Beautiful. Yeah. I mean, the sonic quality of a tape that's degrading is actually I feel it's very, very warm, and I just think it's gorgeous tonal quality.
Yeah, I agree. And I personally discovered a lot of music through that medium, where my siblings may have recorded songs from the radio and then over other songs that were already there. And so for me, it sparks off many things in my mind, listening to music like that. So, well, back to the Crow song, I use the Mellotron to create this repetitious cycle of sounds using different voicings, and I change the speed, and it was a very simple, just four separate tracks, not that much audio, if you want to call it that, and so it was going on a loop like that, but it wasn't the kind of loop that is the same each time around, because you, as it goes around, you can change, you can push the faders up and down.
Right.
So it mightn't be the same the next time around, you know, but basically you've got the same elements turning each. Sometimes you don't hear them. Sometimes they come back. So that felt perfect for me. I'm going to close the window. So when I came to recording the vocals, it was in this room. I remember, I think it was, like many of the songs I had recorded, it was at nighttime. I might have just finished watching a film. And just before going to bed, I had my microphone set up and my little machine. And I thought, I think I know how I'm going to record this. So I got out my notebook and pressed play on my machine, and those little loops started playing. And I put on my headphones. I had a microphone that, not that fancy, actually. A friend of mine had left in the house. My own microphone, I'd blown it for some reason. I don't know. Something happened with the phantom power and it wasn't working.
Okay.
So at that moment, I had my friend's mic. Not a high-end microphone at all, but you know, sometimes that doesn't matter.
Right.
Know? I think.
I agree.
Yeah. Very yeah. Nice. So it was quite close. The microphone was, I went up quite close to it and pressed play and started reading the story. But I think things like that can be misleading when someone tells you something is spoken word. You see, I don't really see that piece as spoken word as such. Because for a start, there's music involved and there's musicality in the way it's delivered.
Yeah.
Everyone has musicality in their voice, but it's not always the case that if you're reciting something, it's not always the case that you're really inhabiting it in a musical way.
Right.
I think. So anyway, I felt that I fell straight into it. And I was able to allow the inflections in my voice and in the words come together and meld into this music, that loop that I created. And so it was just one single take.
Okay.
Late at night.
Right.
So there was no demo.
In that room.
In the room I'm sitting in right now, yeah.
Fantastic.
So there was no demo. Yeah, and sometimes you create something new and you're not quite sure about it. You think, oh, is that too much? But at the time you knew, you really felt it. But you come later on, say the next day, I was thinking about it, even though I didn't listen back. I think I had gone for a walk and I was wondering to myself, I wonder how that thing turned out that I made last night, you know? Mm-hmm. And when I did listen back to it, I thought, yeah, this is pretty heavy. This is pretty full on, very, very, I was going to say dense, but I don't think that's right. It's just, cause there is space in it, but it's not a conventional song. It's not the kind of song that piece that is going to sit in the background, I think. Well, I don't, you know.
No.
Maybe. I'm not
sure. No, it demands attention, I think.
That's it.
For sure. And I think, you know, I understand your hesitancy there to go with the term spoken word. But I do think there is some sort of difference that happens that's when something's not just sung and it's more towards spoken delivery. I feel like it kind of demands your attention in a different way. But yeah, that's so interesting to know that. That's how it was recorded in that room late at night, one take. And that's the one that's on the album. And I thought I wonder if maybe you want to talk a bit about your process. Cause I know eventually you went to work with John Parrish, who's a very well-known producer, well-revered producer. And, but to now hear that, well, okay. So did he recognize the beauty in that one late night take and say, Adrian, no, you need to keep it this way? Or was it also a matter of, you know, we only have this much time, so we're going to embellish more of these other songs, or a combination of that, or how did that all play out?
Well, yeah, when I sent John my home recordings, he suggested, 12 songs that we concentrate on for the album. So then we met up in Bristol and I brought over all my recordings and we set them up in the studio. And for that song, it wasn't I mean, we figured out that we probably did have enough time to record the album that we wanted to do, but only, well, on the first day I realized John was fully intending to keep, say, 80% of my vocals that I had recorded at home.
Wow.
As great. The final vocals. Yeah. And for Crow Song, he said, yeah, okay, this has got it. This has got it. All we need to do is see if we can add more. See what happens.
Okay.
He felt there was a scope to bring a few more elements into it. And so he played on the track after my voice goes, all these other things start happening.
Yeah.
And those were put in the studio. There's so my friend Sean McRae-Lane, he plays bass clarinet on the album, and Shalomo, which is like this early version of a clarinet, very short instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually, oh yes, and some piano too. John plays piano on it.
Okay.
And then we tried some backing vocals, which we didn't keep. The three string players, Lisa, Kate, and Cora, they all can sing, you know, and we had them doing these spooky choral notes. But
did you know?
We just pulled back then. We didn't keep them in the end.
Do you have a rough mix with that stuff somewhere? Or did you not even get that far?
I'm trying to remember. No, the mix you hear is the mix.
Yeah.
Actually. Yeah. Yeah, and it came together very fast, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was wondering, gosh, if this appears on the album, because we hadn't chosen the final tracks for the album at that stage. We had a few more than we could fit on to a record. And then when it came to it, we thought, okay, we better decide what's making the cut for the album. And I was really happy to have John like heavily involved in this part of the process.
Yeah.
I was fully confident to go with his suggestions on what should be the first track, what should be the last one.
Sure.
What should be on it. And when he said, yeah, Crow Song is going to be on the record, I was delighted.
Hmm.
And also I knew that it was going to be a challenge for people to hear it, I think. For some
really?
People, I don't know. Well, maybe.
Am I just the opposite from most people then, in that I just hone in directly on the one that you think might be a challenge?
Well, I think it's good to have that at the back of your mind, because it's a sign that you're trying new things anyway, isn't it? It's a sign that you're pushing yourself into different directions.
Yes.
Conscious of the fact that you're offering something of a different tone, different flavor, maybe taking some kind of risk. But to me, it felt totally right. Like all the things that you commit to on the record,
yeah,
they feel totally right. Even though you think, whoa, I wonder what people are going to think of it. But there's always, for me, in my whole process of writing, I always, very, it's a very important thing that I do all the time, every day, is ask everyone to leave the room mentally. Like you don't want people sitting there. I'm talking like metaphorically. You don't
right.
you don't
all the
want
people
to be
in your head or anything.
Yes,
yeah.
Or what people will think. That has absolutely no relevance.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, or we'll just get in your way if you let it.
Yes. Now, I don't mean to confuse that with you're writing a song to somebody.
Mm.
You know, you're writing a song.
Right. No, no.
With someone in mind. That's totally right. different.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's these critics. Oh, but what would Johnny think about if I put this note in here? I don't think Johnny would like that, you know.
Exactly.
Which goes through all of our heads, you know. I actually on one of these podcasts I was doing, there was I think I'd tell this without giving the specific content, but there was one of them where the subject matter was something that I had one particular person in mind, someone I don't even know that well. I thought, I wonder what if I feel like maybe that might put this person off if they hear it. And I ended up getting positive feedback about that section from that person in particular. You know, it just,
oh wow.
It's very, very strange. Very strange. Those things.
Yeah.
But Adrian, I think it's time we have a listen to Crow Song. Are you up for that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because I'm eager as well to get a bit more into the story, because it's the story itself that is most intriguing to me here. And I'll not say anything more about it, because I think the song tells so much of a story that we should give the song the chance to tell it first, but then we can go back and see what else we might want to add to that.
Okay.
So let me see here.
Solitary crow with a crippled wing, you came at night to the doorstep. I rescued you from the storm, the Atlantic wind and rain, ripped from the blackness to rest in my hand. With gaping beak and blinking eye and all but spent, solitary crow. You in the cardboard apple box, not sure if you'd make it to morning. In the spare room, I stood on the stone floor by the window and watched the lights across Galway Bay like smugglers' lanterns, and the trees bucking in the wind. Solitary crow. I fed you treats saved and gathered from the table in the tangled garden. Macaroni and cheese, baked Alaska, tapioca, worms, moths, kidney beans, curly whirlies, all manner of things. Solitary crow with a crippled wing. You find your strength again, and there you waited for me on the makeshift perch in the grotto under the blackthorn tree. Solitary crow with a crippled wing. In the coming weeks, I'd cross the tangled path with the treats ready in my little hand. Past the injured rotary washing line, crooked and askew from the prevailing wind, the defunct saloon. I'd find you on your perch waiting for me. Solitary crow with a crippled wing. Then one day you were ready for flight. You lunged skyward with clumsy beats, a squawk of excitement, talons hanging low. Then over my head, and over the fence, over the field of ferns, of lush green viridian, towards the others who watched from the telegraph wires. Solitary crow with a crippled wing. Then I lost sight of you, and you were gone. And I was joyous for you, but shattered nonetheless. Solitary crow with a crippled wing. It was late October the next time I saw you. I was walking along the top of the fence when I looked down and I saw the cluster of bones and black feathers that lay among the rusty bracken. Solitary crow with a crippled wing. And I looked at the sky. And I looked to the sky.
Nice to listen back with you.
Yeah, kind of an odd experience, right? Like, especially over the last year, we've all been so isolated. Like, to sit, I mean, first of all, how often do we, that's what I've enjoyed about doing this, is actually just sitting with people and intentionally listening to music, just a song. It's you realize then how little we do that nowadays.
It's true. So thank you for doing this. It's a wonderful thing to do.
Yeah. Well, Adrian, I'm hugely intrigued by the fact that you had a sort of pet crow or a crow friend living with you for a while when you were younger. Could you fill us in on the details of this story a bit more?
Yes, so the song is set in outside a small village between two villages, actually, where I grew up by the sea on the edge of Galway Bay. And it's a part of the countryside that is very wild. You know, it's on the Atlantic coast. And for anyone listening, you know, on the other side of the world who's never been to Ireland, you might have this picture of this jagged shoreline and crashing waves and rolling fields and trees that grow in the direction of the prevailing wind. That was one thing that always stuck in my mind when I was a kid. So yes, that's where it's set. And one night, I have to also add that the house that I grew up in, is a 1970s style, 1970s bungalow with big windows. Very impractical when you think about the fact that the area was prone to strong gales coming in from the sea. We didn't have double glazing or anything. So these big windows would just like shake and vibrate with the wind. And anyway, and the front door also, I remember it used to shake in the wind. So one night it was shaking a bit more. And then I realized it was because my brother was trying to open the door, and he came inside the hall and he was covered in, he was soaking wet because it was lashing rain outside, but he was carrying something under his coat. And I went up to him and I asked him, I said, "Hey, Mark, what is that?" And he said, "It's a crow.
Wow.
I found it in the storm." And he showed it to me. And it was the strangest thing. I suppose I hadn't really seen a crow up that close before, you know?
Yeah.
Right, like really close. And he said, this thing that really stayed with me. He said, it lost all its oils in the storm. Because, you know, a bird has oils in it.
On its
that
feathers.
Keeps it waterproof.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I didn't know how he could tell this in the middle of, like,
right.
And it was dark. But immediately he assumed that's what was wrong with it. It had been tossed around in the wind and injured, and it was lying down exhausted on the ground when my brother found it. So he brought it in, and he basically handed it over to me. You know, we put it in a, like in the song I mentioned, a cardboard apple box where we put it in there. And then the next day I sort of took over. I, like you said, I'll talk about things that aren't really mentioned in the song. One thing is a really vivid thing was the feeling of its beak against my fingers when I was feeding it. You know,
wow.
I would feed it every day. And not only that, but the smell, because it had this odor about it. Odor.
Wow.
Yeah, it did. And it was very strong. But it was in this little cave that I put it in. And you know, thinking back, I wonder how the cats didn't get at him, or dogs, or foxes, or whatever. But it was there every morning when I went out. And I do remember how it started becoming more responsive, but it was clearly fine with not trying to go anywhere. It wasn't, by the way, it wasn't in a cage or anything. It was in this open space.
Ah, right.
So it
right.
could have left if it wanted to.
Yeah.
But it didn't. And I would go and bring it food.
Yeah.
Because it was very unwell. It couldn't fly.
Yeah.
I suppose it felt safe there. It was a little secure space that I made for it. And so I I would feel it every day, and it would eat out of my hand. So this, the feeling of its beak scraping against my skin was really something.
Wait, so how old were you at this time? Do you remember?
I'm trying to remember how old I was. I think I was 9 or 10.
Uh-huh.
Oh, actually, I must have been. Yeah, I certainly wasn't older than 11 because my brother left home when I was 11.
Right.
So I would hazard a guess that I was 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It feels about right. Yeah. And there was this sort of feeling that it trusted me, but it was still this wild creature. It was quite an exciting thing. I felt really awestruck to be in its presence, to be that close to it, and for it to allow me to be that close to it, and for it to eat out of my hand, because in one sense I was looking at a predator straight into the eye,
right?
Because that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's and it was I remember staring into its eyes for long periods of time and seeing myself in its reflection, and you know, and feeling that it had this collective memory behind those eyes, going back millions of years.
Wow.
And I would ponder on that. I was just, like I said, I was only a little boy.
Yeah.
But these were the things that are going through my mind. And that unbelievable stench. it was like old unwashed laundry that you forgot about in the back of your sports bag or something. You know, that's what it smelled like.
Do you know anyone else, or have you ever heard of anyone who had an experience like this with a crow?
No, but I read a story many years ago about this this girl in America somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
a small girl who had rescued a crow, I think, helped it in some way, saved its life. I don't know if it stayed with her for that long.
Yeah.
But it used to come and bring her presents every morning and leave them on her windowsill.
Beautiful. Wow. I mean, I kind of, when I was thinking about having this conversation with you, I just got curious about, well, how common is this that a crow would in any capacity be around humans, either in a sort of being tamed kind of way, or just if it's injured, being somewhat comfortable. And I started to look up, and of course there are quite a few, like, I'm just going to show you something real quick.
Oh, really?
People who are just listening won't be able to see this, but I'll describe it. I'm just scrolling through what you find if you type in pet crow on YouTube. And funny pet crow clips. Pet crow acts like a dog. What does a pet crow do all day? Pet crow growing up. So there's a lot of people out there with like little pet crows, you know? So I thought that was amazing. I would play one of these, but I don't want to get, you know, this is other people's content, and so I don't want to get in trouble for showing that. But if anyone's curious, there's pet crow is like a dog. It's so funny. And I also notice here something that is common for me, that people seem to interchange crow and raven. They're two birds that have a very similar sort of place in our landscape and in our folklore.
Yes,
they seem almost interchangeable in the context of a story or something.
Yes.
And I when I was thinking about this as well, it reminded me of this is a book that my dad gave to me many years ago. It's called A Year in the Maine Woods. And it's about this guy who just goes and builds a cabin and stays out in the woods for a year. But it starts off when he's driving out there and he had just found a crow with his friend. Or actually, I think in this case, it's a raven. But like I say, they're sort of interchangeable somehow.
Yes.
But he brought this raven with him. There's a beautiful scene in this book where he's driving with this raven, you know, sitting next to him, and he's covered all the seats with, you know, a tarpaulin or something, you know, plastic or something, just so that the raven can feel at home and he doesn't have to worry about his truck or whatever. But he's driving up and he's starting to get to a place. He's had the bird with him for a couple of weeks already, and he can understand when the bird is hungry. And he describes this beautiful relationship he has with the bird, and he has to stop and go in to get some food at a, you know, gas station or something. And he goes and he tells the bird, you know, he's going to be right back. And he goes in and he ends up taking a little longer than he thought. And when he comes back, the whole truck has been trashed. Like the bird is everywhere. And the birds, he describes it as the bird being like traumatized that his daddy left him for a little while. You know?
Gosh.
But it's beautiful. And so yeah, I'm very, and to me as well, the crow and the raven, they're very mystical and magical creatures. And, you know, I really like old folklore stories of symbolic meanings that these animals are associated with.
Yes.
These are something that Bridget and I will pull out from time to time. There are these animal cards, you know, where it's like a deck of cards where like there's each, all these different animals and, you know, they will have different meanings. And so, you know, sometimes we'll pull one out and, you know, maybe ask a question and pull a card and see what sort of thing you get. And, here's as well, how interchangeable crow and raven were. I thought there was a crow in this deck, but now when I pulled it out this morning, it's actually a raven. I haven't done it yet, but I thought maybe I could read to you what it says in the little book for the raven.
Yes, please.
All right. Well, first of all, you pull the card and it says raven, magic. And it says, own your power. And so you go into the book and let me see where it says here. P-R. Yes. The raven. Here's what it says. Trying to keep yourself little by denying your power so you won't be a threat to anyone merely keeps you in a false bubble of safety. Of course, at least that way you won't get noticed much or stand out. Well, that trick has worn out its welcome. You're more powerful than you think you are, so it's time to stop pretending. Those psychic games you play, like finding convenient parking spaces or knowing when a certain someone is going to call, those are just parlor tricks, yet they're subtle testimonies of the gifts you have. There's no need to take on airs about your incredible talents. Let them serve you, but mainly let them be of service to others, whether human, animal, plant, or mineral. Use your abilities to demonstrate to others that there is amazing power of spirit available that can move mountains, a force that can be accessed with the proper mix of faith, intention, and focus. So stop doubting, worrying, or making excuses, and own your capacity to be a powerful magician. Use these gifts to help make this a better world for all beings. That's the message of the raven.
Wow. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. I also don't like to impose meaning where there is none, you know?
Yes.
Sometimes you can read into anything if you want to, you know, and try to find the meaning of it. But I remember sitting, listening to you play that song the first time. I remember feeling like there was just some sort of deep meaning to that crow's presence in your life. And the fact that it comes back, it stays with you all these years and finds its way first into a story in a book. And then, like you said, insisting again to be made into song. And, you know, I don't want to impose meaning there. But I don't know if it needs to be defined what the meaning of that crow is, but, I don't know. Is there anything else that you think of when you think of that crow's present in your life? Was it an especially crowly period for you? I had to get that pun in there somewhere.
That is so funny. It would be shame not to. It's so good, it doesn't even need an answer. Such a good question. Oh, that's funny. But isn't it fascinating, though, how something can enter your life in that way and inhabit your subconscious and return at times? It's like when you're open to all the worlds of life, things arrive in your life in moments and are pregnant with potency, so potent that it can't be administered in one go. And it just, like I said before, insists itself back onto you. It's hard not to use bird metaphors, but it alights on your shoulder when you don't realize, you don't expect it to. And it is a mysterious thing. But at the heart of it, it's to do with heart. If that doesn't sound too obscure, because we're creatures of heart, and we are open, and that's how we discover and create and affect others. So I think as children we're extremely open.
Yeah,
we're so open.
Mm.
And as adults, we want to be in that same way. In many ways.
Is that a cultural thing at all, or is that a human thing?
I would hope it's a human thing. Maybe in culture, different modern cultures, we are sort of masked off to experience all the full colors of kind of visceral and psychic and primal sensations, you know.
Yeah.
But in simple terms, just the beauty of things. The beauty of things around you.
The raw beauty. Yeah.
Yeah. And a sense of wonder, because that is a thing that children tap into or are inhabited by. Is a sense of wonder and discovery. Imagine not feeling like you're discovering anything. Or...
Well, that's what cynicism kind of is in my eyes. Like it's when you fail to notice the beauty and that's literally all around you. Like, I would imagine if you're in solitary confinement in a prison cell for a crime you didn't commit, I'm not trying to unacknowledge anyone's struggle, but, you know, I feel like if you open your, it's amazing because when I think of childlike wonder, the first thing I see in my head is those eyes, the eyes that are really open and like, you know, I'm going to put them up to the screen. They're like, you know,
exactly. And exactly.
Honestly, try and do that with your eyes and you will start to feel wonder. Let's look at something like that for a moment. Anything, something that you might think is not magical at all. Just let me see here. Look, just here's a beanie cap. Just
okay.
Wow. Just look at that for a moment with those eyes, and I start to see all the little fibers and just the vibrant green of this thing, you know. Like you were saying, just when you're a child, you are more prone to that somehow. And this came to you when you were a child. So you were very much still in that state of wonder.
Yes. And I absolutely agree about looking at things with wide eyes and how it invites wonder back to you.
Mm.
Because you don't walk around every day with your eyes like that, you know?
No,
it's true, you don't.
You furrow your brow and you're kind of, you know, it's the opposite of the stink eye, which is where you close your eyes. It's the opposite of wonder, isn't it?
Yeah. That's so funny. Yeah. That's one of my favorite American terms. I assume it is American because I
have stink eye.
Yeah, it's so funny. Yeah.
Again, did you just give me the stink eye?
Very funny.
I cut off someone in traffic and they gave me the stink eye.
Is that
imagine if you looked at someone with wonder when they cut you off in traffic.
Imagine.
Whoa!
they might crack a smile and you know.
They might.
Yeah. Apparently that is a good trick to have if you're experiencing road rage, just
laugh.
Well, I don't drive. I don't. Yeah, something like that.
Laugh at the ridiculousness.
Don't respond in kind.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder what people think of this conversation we're having about childlike wonder, the Atlantic coast, mysterious birds that appear in your life.
Do you envision performing this song much once you, you know, can get back on the road again?
I would like to, yes. I think it very much depends on the setting. The yeah. mood at the time, the space, the energy that people bring to the room first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there is a kind of there is a sensation surrounding that this song. It's sort of like if you're huddled together in a space. Yeah. I think I would like to perform it more.
Yeah.
If I feel it's been invited in the right context.
Yeah.
I think it's the kind of song that you can't just like write down on a set list and assume that you're going to be on it at the moment.
So, yeah, I can see that absolutely. You know, it might not be a big festival banger.
Exactly. On the main stage.
The main stage.
Oh,
But that's the way a festival should be, man. I'll tell you.
I agree.
We got to make our own festival.
I agree.
Well, I'd love to finish this off. I'd love to play the only other version of the song that I know of, which is this recording that of the from the gig that you and I did together, which was beautifully filmed by a crew of people down there in Kilkenny. So big thanks to all of them. It was Labyrinth Management and Events who put it all together, and the Set Theater, and a bunch of other folks working on video and sound. So I'll play that. But if there's anything else you want to say, or if there's anything that you're working on now that you are excited about, or any last words from you, Adrian.
I'm thankful that we're continually and continuously inspired. You know, it's just a wonderful thing. So yes, in this room that I'm speaking to you from now, I've been writing more stories, mm-hmm. and I'm just very excited.
Great,
it's a great feeling.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
so thank you.
Thank you, Adrian.
thank you, Peter.
Thank you so much, and I hope everyone who hasn't heard your record will go and check it out. And I hope we can share the stage together again soon.
That'll be amazing. Yeah.
Are you gonna watch the Crow Song again with me now?
I think I will.
Okay.
I haven't watched it.
Okay.
Actually.
All right. Yeah. Well, here we go. And there's a bit of piano in this version, which I think is cool. Like, you know, I love the way a song can evolve to include different instrumentation and arrangements. So this version is a bit different. Here we go. Thanks for listening, everybody, and keep it real out there.
Solitary crow with a crippled wing. He came at night to the doorstep. I rescued you from the storm, the Atlantic wind and rain. Ripped from the blackness to rest in my hands. With gaping beak and blinking eye, and all but spent. Solitary crow with a crippled wing. I put you in a cardboard apple box, not sure if you'd make it till morning. In the spare room, I stood on the stone floor by the window and watched the lights cross Galway Bay. Guttering like smugglers' lanterns. the trees all bucking in the wind. Solitary crow with a crippled wing. In the coming weeks, I fed you treats, saved and gathered from the table and the tangled garden. Macaroni and cheese, baked Alaska, tapioca, worms, moths, kidney beans, curly whirlies, all manner of things. Solitary crow with a crippled wing. To help you find your strength again. And there you waited for me on the makeshift perch, in the grotto under the blackthorn tree. Solitary crow. In the coming weeks, I'd cross the tangled path with the treats ready in my little hand. Past the injured rotary washing line, crooked and askew from the prevailing wind. The defunct swing ball pole, the broken down family saloon. I'd find you on your perch, waiting for me. Solitary crow with a crippled wing. Then one day you were ready for flight. You lunged skyward with clumsy beats. A squawk of excitement, talons hanging low. Then over my head, and over the fence, and over the field of ferns, of lush green viridian, towards the others who watched from the telegraph wires. Solitary crow with a crippled wing. Then I lost sight of you, and you were gone. And I was joyous for you, but shattered nonetheless, but shattered nonetheless. Solitary crow with a crippled wing. Solitary crow with a crippled wing. Late October the next time I saw you, I was walking along the top of the fence, and I saw the cluster of bones and black feathers that lay among the rusty bracken. And I looked to the sky. And I looked to the sky.